Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. I am very, very excited for this episode. I've very rarely been more amped to share a guest with my audience. I love fresh voices. I love authentic voices. I love resilient voices. And he checks all the boxes. Please welcome former Patriarch of Crime Family soldier, enforcer, war general, Vincent G.G. Marino. It's only been a couple months since he's been free. He was locked up for 3 decades. I'm very excited to let him share his story with you guys. Thank you so much, G.G., for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
What's it like now? You know, you were in for 28 years?
28 years. Since 1996.
How's the adapting been?
Yeah, it's a whole new world. I mean, there's traffic everywhere. There's potholes everywhere. The food is amazing. Everything's upscale. The technology is through the roof. I mean, everything's great. You know, you have your positives and negatives, like anything else.
Is it overwhelming?
It's overwhelming, but you can take it in perspective. You take your time with it, and you get used to it. You adapt.
So let's kind of go a little bit chronologically. But I want to just preface this with, I think a lot of people, they have an idea of the general narrative of what happened in the Patriarch of Crime Family and the war that broke out in the summer of 89 and was off and on again until 95, 96. Cadillac Frank Salemi on one side and J.R. Russo and Vinnie Ferrara and some of the other guys, North End, East Boston guys on the other side. I don't think people really understand the federal corruption, the government corruption that was immersed in this particular feud. And a lot of the oxygen gets sucked out of the room when you're talking about Whitey Bulger and the corruption that was involved in his case. And I'm not dismissing the John Conley Bulger angle, but there was a lot of shadiness in your situation that really hasn't been exposed. And I hope that through this conversation, we can at least touch on some of it. Would you say that's accurate before we go back and kind of start?
Very accurate. The FBI and the Department of Justice and their prosecuted lawyers instigated and fomented violence in Boston. That erupted and a lot of people were dead, shot, and stabbed because of the fomenting of violence. They basically wanted to get Salemi out of the way and no matter what price it had, you know, they had to pay for it.
And they were operating, you know, made guys as confidential informants as the war was going on. And just like you saw with Bulger and in what you saw in New York with Greg Scarpa, it looks like to the naked eye that the government was tipping people off, tipping off mobsters to where their enemies would be and how to, they weren't trying to stop crime. They were facilitating it.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what they did in Boston. And they do it pretty much nationwide. It's called, they had a book called COINTELPRO. What they do is they come from within and they get everybody shooting and stabbing and killing each other. And they take control of the whole situation. And they had another thing called the Top Echelon Informant Program that was brought in by J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director back then. And what they did was they flipped informants who were high ranking. And to meet that criteria, they had to be an accomplished professional serial killer. They had to have been a high-ranking member of a criminal organization, and they also had to be able to disseminate that information to the Department of Justice lawyers and the FBI. So keep that in mind, that they were dealing with killers that were working for the government, at the same time fomenting other violence against other people.
And it also, and again, I'm digressing, but I'm going to get back on point in a second. This goes beyond your region, but it includes your region.
Correct.
And this is stuff that I want to report on in the future. And when I say in the future, like immediately. I believe that at the very least, at the minimum, throughout the 90s and part of the 2000s, maybe even back to the 80s, the FBI was operating at least three mafia dons as cooperators, as CIs, dry, in some ways dry snitches. And then eventually they flip Joe Mussino in New York. And it just, to me, and then we know about Whitey, it seems so backwards to be using the kingfish to take down the smaller fish. The way it should be is you're taking the smaller fish to lead you to the big fish. Right. It all got flipped around and warped.
Correct. And they were doing it without any transparent corresponding accountability whatsoever. They were just doing it with impunity.
Right. Well, so let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Revere, right?
Yes. Born in Boston, grew up in Revere, lived in East End, in the North End.
Star athlete, homecoming king.
Yeah, I played all sports. Football, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Indoor track, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Ski club, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Student council, class rep, king of the prom. The base, you know, I was involved with things, you know.
Did you go to college or did you go right into it?
Believe it or not, I went 1 year at Bunker Hill Community College. They call it the bank robbery school at Boston.
Right.
I went there 1 year. That was it. I took up criminal justice, by the way.
Yeah, that's appropriate. So who did you gravitate to in terms of the LCN guys? I know who you ended up close to, but what was your entry point in the early
years? I was very friendly. My grandfather was Vincent Gigi Santapio. That's who I was named after on my mother's side of the family. And he was a professional middleweight boxer. An accomplished boxer, and he was probably one of the biggest bookmakers in history. Back in 56 years ago, he was making like $9 million a year, back 60 years ago, which is a lot of money in today's standards. I mean, he was doing very well with it, but he was the type of guy who loved to help people. He was good with people. He used to give money away, and he was a gambler. You know, he liked to drink, and he liked to, you know, fast women, fast cars, and slow horses.
Right. Was he Eastie?
He was Eastie. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, at what point do you get introduced to J.R. Russo and the East?
I mean,
End?
I was friendly, boss. You know, because they knew my grandfather, and you know how everything works is you trace you back to the old country,
right?
And who you are, you know. And my mother's side was from Naples, and my father's side was from Shaka, Sicily. And that was the Marino side. And the Santapio side was like right outside of Rome and Naples. And that's where they were from. My grandfather was one of 18 children. So they all had to feed the family. So one was a bookmaker, one was a baker, one was a Shylock, you know, one was a boxer. I mean, they all had different trades to feed the family because 18 of them came over at once from Naples.
You know, if we're just talking about, you know, East Boston, we're talking about things that kind of get lost through history and narratives. And we're not talking Nobel Peace Prizes here or in morals and ethics. I'm talking about if you're analyzing it as what it is. And I think J.R. Russo is just a very underrated figure in the history of LCN. He is a guy that, within the world of the Patriarchas, definitely wasn't underrated. I mean, he was known as a force to be reckoned with from a very young age. But I think if you're not from Boston, if you're not from New England, he's not a name that you necessarily always hear about in terms of the mythology. And this guy was, you know, they talk about, sometimes I make the analogy to athletes, like, you know, a baseball player, a great prospect is called, you know, five-tool guy. J.R. Russo checked a lot of boxes. Natural leader, fearless, capable, big money maker, you know, dressed impeccably. What were your memories of J.R. Russo?
All around great guy, super intelligent, very classy, very respectful. He's an all around good guy. I mean, if he was in another field, he'd probably be like a scientist. You know what I mean? He was just super, super, super respected.
So let's just go to, I guess, jump ahead to mid to late 87. You're in your late 20s.
Right.
Frank Salemi comes out of prison after 15 years. He clearly had a blueprint for what he wanted to do. He was a Boston guy who, when he came home, was viewed as an interloper or as a carpetbagger, even though he was from Boston. He aligned with the Providence guys and aligned with a lot of Irish guys. When did you start sensing that this was going to be an issue? When he comes in like a wrecking ball, comes out of prison, and immediately is exerting authority on behalf of Raymond Jr.
Right. Well, three FBI agents approached me coming to my house as I was walking into my house in Fennel Street in Revere. One was John Conley, one was Michael Buckley, and one was Robert Callan. And they all presented their badges and they said, listen, we're FBI and we're here to tell you that Frank's trying to kill you. I go, Frank who? They said, Salemi. So I started laughing. They said, what are you laughing about? I said, listen, don't come by here anymore. They said, no, we can help you, this and that. I said, listen, goodbye. Don't come by no more. And I left and I started laughing. And they instigated, like I said, they instigated and fomented the violence by telling people that a certain person is trying to kill them. That, you know, back then, if you read the books, you read the newspapers, this guy is like a professional bomb maker, hypothetically, wiped out, half of Charlestown, him and Barboza. So, somebody you don't want to take lightly. And then they also go to Vinnie Ferrara's lawyer, Anthony Cardinale, at Joe Tecci's restaurant. When Cardinale was there, John Conley walked in there and he says, hey, Anthony, who are you waiting for? So I'm waiting for my client. He says, who's your client? He goes, Vinny the Animal Ferrara. Well, he said, wow, I wouldn't meet him in public. Frank's trying to kill him. So they instigated the whole thing.
They're planting seeds of distrust that weren't necessarily growing organically.
Exactly. The typical theme of the book called COINTELPRO. Instigate and foment violence within. Have them kill each other by, Machiavellian moves, by telling each other they're going to kill you. And then come in and when the dust clears and arrest everybody or whatever. And that's
There were other factors that played into the situation. And I want to get your take on it. I think Raymond Sr., Patriarca, died. I mean, he didn't die suddenly, but it was sudden enough. I know people knew he had heart issues and I don't know if the succession plan was properly thought out. Junior Patriarca was a lot of things. I don't think he was somebody that had the chops to be a Don. And things were already kind of, again, tell me if I'm wrong here. You lived it. I just have researched it. Things seemed to have been, momentum had been against him kind of from day one. Salemi comes out and Salemi recognizes this, I think. And instead of gravitating to his hometown of Boston, he gravitates to the person that he can manipulate and puppet and use to propel his own interests. I could be wrong here, but my take on it is if the succession situation would have been handled differently, maybe you don't even reach the point that you reached in 89.
Yes, you're pretty accurate in a lot of your assumptions, but Raymond was a lot smarter than everybody thought. And Raymond, by him stepping out later on, was actually a very smart move. But think about
it. You're talking about Junior.
Junior, of course. Yeah, okay. I didn't know the father. I knew the son. The son was actually a really nice guy. Okay. They underestimate his intelligence. He was super, really, really smart. really smart guy. I'm not saying he was cut out for this, but he was really an intelligent, educated guy.
Right.
And he kind of like got pushed into it.
Right. And he, I think for self-preservation purposes, he puts Salemi and Billy Grasso kind of in front of him. And like, at what point do you, outside of the government trying to stir the pot, at what point do you feel like there is something to be worried about here?
Well, I mean, at the point when he told, when the FBI told me that Salemi was trying to kill me, I had things to, you know, started thinking about, you know, what's going on next, you know, so I had to keep my eyes and ears on the ground to see what was going on.
And the movement. Do you think that was true? I mean, do you think that they said that?
I didn't want to, you know what I'm saying? I didn't want to underestimate it or overestimate it. So I was kind of like in between. I was paying attention a little more that, at that point.
Were you hearing from the people that you reported to that when Salemi was coming into Boston on business? I mean, he was, I guess he was living in, you know, in the area, but was he, was he ruffling feathers because he was kind of coming in after being gone for so long and trying to, you know, muscle people that
his biggest mistake was not being patient. All he had to do was sit back and be patient because the newspaper was already printing articles how everybody was going away, and then just sit back and said, you know, greed got, you know, the best of him.
So what do you, can you talk about the summer of 89? And, you know, all the stuff erupts in mid-June, you know, going back to the spring of 89, did you sense that that's the direction it was headed in? And what were you guys doing to prepare?
I mean, it was definitely headed in that direction. I mean, you had guys like Angelo Sonny Mercurial, who was wired by the FBI, also instigating the violence on one end. Then you had Whitey Bulger. Steve Reifman Salemi wasn't comfortable with Salemi being around. So they didn't, they weren't comfortable with it. The handlers, Conley and Buckley, weren't comfortable with him being around. So that's, you know, put all that together, you know, it's not going to come out too good for anybody. Or not too many people anyway.
Did you meet Frank? I mean, before the shooting started?
I was friendly with his son. And his son started sneaky moves. So I stepped away from him. I seen some, you know, a little snake in him, and I walked away from him. And he introduced me to the father one day. And actually, the father was really trying to recruit me.
Frank had a lot of positive characteristics, but then he had a lot of negative characteristics. From my research, Frankie Boy had all the bad and none of the good from his father.
He actually had a lot of good, but the bad part is you don't rob your friends. Or you don't
try. He was robbing everybody.
He was robbing everybody, and that's the problem. Like, if he comes to me saying, I want you to introduce me to so-and-so and such, and I'm like, look, this guy's my friend. Don't rob him. And you try to rob him when you know he's my friend, I'm stepping away from you.
Right.
Because it's not going to end up good in the end.
And look at Jimmy Lamoli. I mean, a lot of that had to do with problems that Frankie Boy brought to his doorstep.
Right. Right.
So you had met him through that. I find it interesting also that, and this is different in your neck of the woods than it really is anywhere else, and I'm not sure what the status of the furlough program is now, but unlike other areas, in terms of, at least in the state prisons, guys could come home for the weekend. And I know Cadillac Frank was coming back into town occasionally for the decade before he actually came home. He was dipping in once in a while. Did you know that? Did you hear that?
He was moving pretty quick. And like I said, he wasn't patient. And he was trying to, you know, make power moves. You know what I'm saying? He was, you know, bringing a nice little team together. And, you know, he was actually pretty powerful.
No, he was a natural politician and knew a lot of guys from his earlier days. Did JR know him from back in the day? Did they know each other from back?
Because back in the day, him and Salemi, according to the documents I read and the papers I read and books I read, that they supposedly were instrumental during the Irish gang wars.
Yeah, they were shooters.
And Salemi. And then right. You had a little Mighty Bowser and C.B. Fleming in there, but it was mostly Salemi and Barboza. They were like a killing machine together. And, of course, Barboza flips years later, and Salemi flips years later. And a lot of this comes out. Everything that we're saying is public record.
Yep.
In the public.
However you feel, you know, in terms of your comfort level, whatever you want to say about the Pancake House thing, you know, the government claims that Gigi was the captain of a hit squad that tried to take out Cadillac Frank at a International House of Pancakes in Saugus, Massachusetts. It was Frank and his, at that time, his consigliere, Q-Ball, was there as well. Q-Ball didn't take any fire. Frank took 6 or 7 shots, survived it in the parking lot, took refuge in a pizza parlor.
Right.
And then the aftermath of that turned into a feud between Cadillac Frank and his own people, Junior Patriarca, in terms of who was paying medical bills and whatnot.
Right.
How much do you want to talk about whatever you feel?
It was definitely a mess. I mean, I can go according to public record. Frank was running around town after saying, hey, they didn't have the stones to take him out or finish him off. And he actually made the statement to Walter Steffens, and I have the 302 FBI report that states clearly and conceitedly that the only reason why he was alive that day, not according to me, but according to what the public record says, the FBI FD-302 by Walter Steffens, when he encountered Salemi after he got shot, he started to ask him, you know, he was showing him all where the holes were, you know, all the scars on him. And he made a statement to Steffens, they didn't have the balls to finish him off. And Steffens says, it's not true, Frank. He goes, you know, while they were shooting at you with high power weapons and machine guns, he said a tractor trailer came in between you and cut you off. And that's why you got away. So I have the actual report. This is according to an FBI agent, FBI 302 form, which is an investigative report.
Right.
209 is an informant report.
And let's also mention, and this kind of goes back to one of our original points about the corruption and the puppeteering behind the scenes from the government that people don't know, or that whole supposed sit down or meeting that turned into a hit, that was brokered by Sonny Mercurio. Like, Sonny Mercurio was working
for
the government.
Right.
Right.
You know,
the
funny thing about it, a lot of people don't realize, Bowser, Flemmy, Mercurio was behind it 100%. All of them were top echelon FBI informants. All of them were accomplished professional serial killers. So while they're working for the FBI, their number one goal is to get Salemi killed by going to people like me and other people that they approach, saying he's trying to kill him, to rile everybody up to get it done. They didn't care what it costs or what was involved, but just to get this guy killed. But what they don't realize is while they were trying to prosecute me for it since 89, the reason why they didn't indict me right away was because their three informants was Bowser, Flemmy, and Mercurio. At the time, they were still utilizing them.
Right.
So they didn't want to expose them. So they waited for 7 years, 9 months, 4 days later, indict me for the Flemmy hit, which is over the 5-year statute of limitations. So what they did was they put it in a bracket of 10 years as a predicate weak racketeering act, as opposed to a substantive act, which is much stronger, to get past the statute of limitations to charge me with Salemi. So, and then they use a corrupt FBI agent, Buckley, to slip through all the cracks. He was far more worse than Conley. He was the alternate handle of Whitey Bulger, Stevie Salemi, and Andrew Sonny Mercurio, and a ton of other people. And every person that he handled as an informant, since Leonetti in Philly, by the way, he broke his teeth in Philly. People don't realize that. And Buckley came to Boston and applied his illegal tactics as an FBI agent in Boston, of flipping serial killers and, you know, coaching them how to lie and everything else. That's what basically what they do. But what people don't realize is after Diane Kottmeyer, who was the chief of the organized crime strike force in Boston and became a rewarded Suffolk Superior Court judge after, knew that Mercurio, while working as an FBI informant, set up the Grosso murder in Connecticut, the Salemi attempt that I'm charged with, and I eventually beat a trial, but I got a 25-year enhancement for the conduct. I beat a trial, which now Supreme Court case McClinton says it's illegal. For Amendment 1 of the U.S. Sentencing Guidelines says it is legal. And, of course, H.R., House of Representatives, 1621 bill, bipartisan Republican Democrat, and S-601 in the Senate says it's illegal. But they got away with it. Here I am. I just finished 28. And 25 of it was illegal. You know, I did an extra 25 years in prison for conduct I beat a trial. But not to jump around too much, but Mercurio, after he set up the hits and numerous other murders, while in that formant, the FBI, Connally and Buckley, and chief of the Organized Crime Strike Force, federal prosecutor, Diane Kottmeyer, became a rewarded Suffolk Superior Court state judge, told Mercurio, it's a good time to leave.
Right, he took off.
Told him, don't tell us where you're going. But he goes to Florida. Guess who goes to visit him and gives him money? Agent Buckley, that prosecuted me for the slimy attempt. So wait a minute. Let's get this straight. So you're giving money to the guy to set up the hits, but yet you want to prosecute me and give me 35 years in prison for the hit that I beat at trial. Is there something wrong with that story?
Yeah.
Then the chief of the Organized Crime Strike Force knows too, allows him to flee, tells all the FBI, leave hands off him, don't touch him. So they aid and embedded a fugitive that was involved with numerous murders and attempted murders. And then you want to prosecute me for the hit. When I go to trial and I beat it, I get a not proven beyond a reasonable doubt predicate Racketeering Act A2 and RICO, which stands for Racketeering Influence Corruption Organization, and RICO Conspiracy and Conspiracy Murder. I beat it. The judge is sentencing to the urgent of the government, Jeffrey Auerhahn, who got caught in a lot of corruption with the Ferrara case and the Baroni case, and Cynthia Young, who also got promoted to the chief of the criminal division. This was her first case she prosecuted, and she was the deputy chief of the Organized Crime Strike Force, and we never got that discovery that Mercurio set up the hit. When my lawyer, Sheketoff, who did a very good job, went to court and kept mentioning the names, I'm actually doing all the cross-examinations myself, passing it to him to cross-examine the witness. He did a real good job at it. Judge Gorton in Boston threatened my lawyer and said, I'm going to hold you in contempt of court if you mention them names again. So that's what happened. People don't want to realize that.
So I want to throw in my two cents for a second in terms of what I think is egregious dereliction of duty. So everybody ends up going to prison for the most part pretty shortly after the dust up in June of 89. By early 90, everybody's pretty much locked up. Cadillac Frank is able to return. He had left. He had gone to California. I think he was in some other places laying low. Mm-hmm. Nicky Bianco, for a second, stabilizes things, and he gets locked up, and Frank comes home and slides into the boss's chair. The narrative that was always put out there was that then everything stopped. Everything didn't really stop. There were several murders that were, in my research, that were retribution murders that Salemi headed conspiracies on, trying to avenge anybody that opposed him and had tried to kill him back in 89. And for his entire reign, pretty much, he's exacting these revenge murders. And I believe you were targeted in some of them. He gets locked up. He eventually flips. Right. The government is so eager to get Conley in the Boulder situation. And I said this to Frank, just full transparency. I mean, Gigi knows this. I think I've spoken about this before on the pod. For a short period of time, I was in talks and working on a book with Cadillac Frank before he got arrested and pulled out of the witness protection program in 2016. And I even said this to him, and he didn't really have a answer.
No, he wouldn't.
The government allowed him to skate on probably 8 to 12 murders and murder conspiracies that he didn't say a peep about, including Stevie DeSaro, which is what got him yanked out of witness protection. And that really had nothing to do with the war. That had nothing to do with something else. But he cops to all the murders that he committed during the Irish mob wars of the 60s, where he cops to 9 or 10 murders. Fine. But then you're telling me that the government, in good conscience, the FBI agents that were debriefing him, that were making the deal, are you telling me that they didn't know that he killed all those people between 90 and 90 in 95, 96? Of course they did.
Of course they did. 100%.
So that's a big issue that I have or had.
Huge issue. And another thing that should be brought up, they charged us with a war. I got 35 years. Some of my co-defense got, one got 28 RICO, one got 22, one got 18, all on pleas, 10 and whatever. A war is two sides shooting at each other, killing each other. We're the only ones who got charged.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
What was the media coverage at that time? It seemed like they were covering the individual the murders and whatnot, but they weren't really putting a narrative together that Salemi was going after the people that had gone after him at one time.
Right. And like you said, all them murders got a complete whitewash. Because basically how they did it was when he flipped Salemi and he debriefed, he made some type of secret deal with them that he wasn't going to tell on the people that he ordered. All them murders could amount to anywhere from 15 to 30.
Right.
It's not counting the conspiracy to murders. And like you said, he got a free pass on it. He got a free pass on it. But his biggest mistake was when he debriefed, he left out DeSaro. Why did he left out DeSaro? Because he didn't want to implicate his son, but his son was dead.
He didn't want to implicate his brother. He didn't want to implicate his brother.
Yeah. And his brother. And that's what the problem, that why he got the life sentence later. After he flipped, they pulled him out of witness protection and they gave him a life sentence for the murder that he left out. Now, had he debriefed on that, he would have never got charged with, because that's basically how they work.
And as I said before, I'm of firm belief, including DeSaro, but another, like I said, another probably 8 to 10, if not more, murders and murder conspiracies. I just can't imagine the family, Stevie DeSaro's wife and her kids, being forced to wait an extra 20 years, more than 20 years, to get closure on something where you had the person that ordered it and watched it completed and then took the body and helped bury it in an FBI debriefing room 6 years after it happened. Why do you have to wait another 15 after that because of a fluke that Billy Ricci ends up getting busted for illegal marijuana grows, and he uses the get out of jail free card, like, oh, by the way, if you dig underneath my building where I was growing all that stuff, you'll find a body. Uh-huh. And if it's, why should the DeSaro family have to suffer because the FBI wants to help make other cases and ignore? I mean, who's the arbiter? Who decides what cases deserve to be made and what cases deserve to be swept under the rug?
I agree. There's some accountability issues for sure.
So can you talk about that a little bit, though, from being in the middle of it? So Salemi takes power. J.R. Russo's off the street. Vinny Ferrara's off the street. Are you guys saying to yourself, like, wow, we're really in the crosshairs now?
Right. We were pretty much, when everybody got swept and Frankie went through his little rigmarole of killing 20, 30 people, he pretty much was in control. And then I come back out of prison and pretty much all my friends are not around. They're either in prison or they're dead. You know what I mean? And, you know, the deck was sacked. The deck was sacked against us. You know what I mean?
And so, they were stalking you guys at your social club. I mean, there was shootings and conspiracies that were being carried out right in East Boston in front of where you guys were hanging out. Was it called Breed Hill?
It was a corner of Brooks, I believe, in Bennington Street.
Okay. Right? Did the social club have a name?
Salon was called.
Well, I mean, the government called it the War Room, but what was the name of it?
I thought it was called Breed Hill.
Yeah. Oh, that was another incident. That was where an incident started, but the club was Corner Brooks and Bennington Street.
Okay.
It was like, you know, a gambling den.
Right.
Yeah.
And we don't have to, you know, name any names or anything, but you know, the government was saying that you guys were being coached by certain people that were locked up. Can you
That's what they say, but I mean nothing can beat like really live on the street. I mean, you know, you look out your window and you see a guy walking up and down the street with a bag with a 45 in it. I mean, he's definitely not selling Avon.
Right.
You know what I mean? Another guy dressed in and another guy was dressed in drag, you know, with the wig and the lipstick and a bulletproof vest and a hatchet to chop your head off. He definitely wasn't, you know, trick-or-treating. You know what I mean? So, you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, just some things are just so obvious.
What was the...
You don't know about that?
No, I've heard about that, and I heard about another one where he wanted to get dressed up as like a Hasidic Jew.
I mean, we actually had the wig at trial. It was on the table. You know, I had to go up there and look and see if it was a real good wig. I guess it was. But not good enough.
Try to take yourself away from being a participant, and I know it's not easy, but from a tactical perspective, I think it was smart of Salemi to surround himself by young Irish thugs that were trigger happy and kind of emulated him. It gave him a layer of protection and muscle that he wouldn't have had if he hadn't have been open to bringing those Irish guys around him. Was that something that you guys were, you know, commenting on in real time?
He had a mixed batch of people around him. But the funny thing is, when an outsider usually gets involved, they usually the first to go. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even their business. You know what I mean?
But he was you can hear him on some tapes where he's telling people that he's talking to. I got some real tough Irish kids that are around me.
I mean, he had Richie Devlin.
Richie Gillis. I mean, right.
Richie Devlin, according to news accounts, chopped the guy's head, two arms, and for some reason left one leg hanging, chopped the other leg off. Mm-hmm. With an hatch in his chest, floating in the Boston Harbor. He goes to state prison with a 10-year plea. And while he's in there, they blame him and charge him with stabbing the Boston Strangler 136 times.
Killing the Boston Strangler, right. Yeah.
Goes to trial and gets a not guilty. I mean, the guy got a pretty good reputation. You know, modern day Hannibal Lecter type of guy. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
And then he had Richie Gillis around him too, who survived 10.
Nine Lives Gillis. I mean, he's the luckiest person on the planet. I mean, one guy shot his eye out. Another guy shot his teeth out. Another guy in the North End shot him up and threw him in a grave, and he crawled out of the grave. I mean, this guy's not meant to die.
Do you believe that Salemi had no idea, honestly had no idea that Flemmy and Bulger were informing?
I think he did, because if he did, he would have killed them. I mean, he's not going to hesitate with that. I don't think he did. I don't think he wanted to believe it either. You know what I'm saying? Because something leaked out in the paper. I think it was the Boston Globe.
Yes.
They did an article, I think it was in 98, saying
it was 88.
Saying that Mercurial, St. Laurent from Rhode Island, Steve Reifman, Flemmy, James Whitey Bulger, There was like five of them. They identified pitches, big article in the paper. Then they had to retract because they said their life was in danger. You know what I mean? That's when the leak came. And that's when Morris admitted to being the source. Morris, who was taking the payoffs from Bulger, the FBI agent supervisor, admitted for being the source of that newspaper article. And then he had to retract it because their current informants were in danger. So, I mean,
were you present or active in any of the peace negotiations in 89-ish?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. I mean, people mentioned that I was, but I wasn't.
Okay. It's interesting to me that I learned, again, just from deep diving court documents and testimony, I think, again, there are narratives and then there are what's true. And sometimes there are, you know, kernels of truth in the narratives, but context is missing. And I always believed that Bobby DeLuca was a Cadillac Frank guy from day one. And it appears from looking at the documents and the testimony, Bobby DeLuca did not become close with Frank Salemi until Frank Salemi became boss. And when the turmoil was at its apex, they were using DeLuca as a go-between because DeLuca was close with J.R. Russo and Vinny Ferrara. And that Ferrara actually proposed DeLuca for his button. I didn't know any of that.
I thought it was Raymond that got him in.
Saying that he had a relationship with JR and Vinny to the point where they sent, and this came out at Frank Salemi's murder trial, they sent Bobby DeLuca the night of the shooting, I think June 13th of 89, they sent him to the North End that night to meet with JR and Vinny.
Maybe they thought he was expendable too.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
He didn't have a button at that point.
But I'm saying they might have thought too, if they sent this guy, he gets killed, who cares? You know what I'm saying? Yeah? Like use him as a pawn.
Yeah.
In a chess game. I think that might have been the reason.
Let's play the kind of I know that hindsight's 2020, and you can't go back and play musical chairs and historical chain of events. But let's just say the making ceremony isn't bugged and there is no Sonny Mercurio and Junior Patriarca steps away. Nikki Bianco becomes boss. J.R. Russo's consigliere. And there are no indictments coming. Could everybody have coexisted?
I believe they could have. I believe they could have. Without the FBI instigating and fomenting violence. Right.
I'm saying take all that stuff out. I know it's hard to do that.
But was gonna coexist to a certain extent. Like I said, people can't be greedy. They have to be patient. You know what I'm saying? Yeah? I mean, it was already put in the articles that these guys were going away and they just kept getting more hungrier and hungrier. More greedy.
Was JR happy with just being the consigliere? Would that have been enough for him to say, I control
Boston? Well, realistically, when the dust cleared, he wasn't just that. He was number one. He was number one. Believe me when I tell you. He was number one. I mean, the guy is a great guy. You know what I mean? He deserved all the accolades. You know what I'm saying? I mean, look what they charged him with. They charged him with killing the first guy ever on the Federal Witness Protection Program in San Francisco in 1976. It's not something I'm disclosing. It's public record.
And on a wire, there are people saying that he's a real artist with the machine gun.
Exactly. So that alone, traveling from Boston to San Francisco while a guy is on the Federal Witness Protection Program. He was the first guy ever to be killed. Now, Joe was smart. At trial, he was charged with it. And he didn't say he did it. He didn't say he didn't do it. He pled what you call an Alford plea. You know what an Alford plea is? Alford is a Supreme Court case
for
North Carolina or something. And what it says is, I'm admitting to this charge. I'm not admitting to it. I'm saying you might have enough to convict me, but I'm not admitting to doing it. And it's a very safe plea. It's called
You're saying that you can punish me for if I did this, but I'm not admitting to doing this.
I'm not admitting guilt, and they cannot use that as a predicate act on anything. You understand what I'm saying? So it's not, it doesn't have the significance of an actual plea of guilty. It doesn't have that strength of it. But when the case was weak against him, too, it wasn't that strong. You remember, you're talking 1976.
Right.
Too many witnesses around.
What were you hearing in the years after the first stage of the war dissipates and Kevin Hanrahan ends up getting killed in the fall of 92, and it comes out in the last couple of years that was all related to a dispute between Raymond Jr. in prison and Frank Salemi and Louis Minocchio, that Jr. felt, or didn't feel, Jr. was offended because Cadillac Frank stole a car collection of very expensive classic cars that Jr. was one of his prized possessions. I think he had it in an airplane hangar. And when with him in prison, Cadillac Frank was mad that his medical bills were not covered like they had been promised. He takes the car collection, he sells it, he pockets the money, tells Jr. basically to go fuck himself. Jr. reaches out to Hanrahan, who was working for Salemi, and gets him to start plotting to murder Salemi in Minocchio. Did you know any of this back then, that was going on?
I'll tell you, I heard it. I don't think it was just over medical bills. That might have been a little part of it, but
yeah.
Salemi definitely did send a message. I mean, for sure. He really wasn't working for Salemi. He was working for Raymond. So right. Salemi was killing off all the people that he didn't like, friends and people that were, you know, helping him out, or people that could kill him. You right. know what I'm saying? I mean, that's all public record.
Right.
I believe Salemi made the brief. He admitted that. Although he got a lot of free passes on a lot of murders, Frank, when he flipped.
That's what I'm saying. There was probably 8 to 10 murders that he just pretended that he didn't know anything about.
Right. Yep. He got a lot of free passes.
And nobody checked him on it. And because you can't tell me that the prosecutors and the FBI agents that were doing that debriefing weren't sitting there saying, that's bullshit. There's no way you don't know anything about these 6, 7, 8, however many murders that happened on your watch when you were the boss.
Right. True.
They didn't want to hear it.
No. They looked the other way. When it benefits them, they look the other way. If they're flipping a guy, they're going to look the other way.
Was there some, I don't know if poetic justice is the right term, but like you guys are sitting there dealing with what you guys had to deal with. This was, I'm saying, in the early, in the years after the 89 shooting. And whatever you knew, whether you knew a lot of it or just small pieces of it, was there some like, wow, those guys are falling, you know, those guys are self-imploding?
Yeah, what?
Was there some type of maybe poetic justice sitting there knowing that Salemi and Jr. and all those guys were self-destructing, imploding after they had, you know, opposed you guys, right. And they couldn't get along.
Right. No, that was definitely poetic justice, for sure.
So talk about, you know, the end in 96. I know you, one of somebody close to you got, was it your bodyguard got killed?
Very, very nice guy. Very, very nice guy. I mean, the government kind of equated him as a modern day Animal Lecter, but he was really, really a nice guy. And
Bobby Nogueira?
Right. It was a fluke that he got killed. He was really a fluke. I mean, he shouldn't have got killed.
But can we color up? It was a night in the fall of 96. They tried to shoot you.
Right. And keep in mind, for the record, this was nothing to do with Salemi. They were like, Salemi hit back.
It had nothing to do with it.
They were all hiding under their bed. No, they didn't hit back. That was just a fluke situation where people were drunk and high and got paranoid and thought I was trying to kill them. And it had nothing to do with mob related whatsoever.
Okay.
Not at all.
But shortly thereafter, you came out the street.
I almost took the gun away from both of them. They were shaking like a leaf. You know what I'm saying? And so it wasn't.
There wasn't much longer. You weren't on the street much longer after that.
Right. I got set up by John Smiley Mealy, an accomplished serial killer, witness protection. He's on witness protection now. They gave him over $500,000 just to lie on the stand against me. And what happened was I got arrested with Mealy. Now, this is a funny, this you're going to like this one. Not too many people know this. John Smiley Mealy, which is publicly known, we were wired for the DEA. Charlie McConnell was half Italian, half Irish. Very good friend of mine. Both of them were wired for the FBI. But Mealy didn't know McConnell was wired. McConnell didn't know Mealy was wired. So McConnell was targeting me and Mealy, and Mealy was targeting me and McConnell. Guess what? There's no conspiracy. You can't conspire with agents or informants of the government. So really, when I took the 10-year plea, I took it so my brother wasn't going to get arrested. There was no crime committed. So I took a plea. They find out later that McConnell was informant. They were supposed to rescind that conviction. They didn't do it. And it's all factual record. It's all public record in the public domain. McConnell was wired. So therefore, there was no conspiracy. I never got caught physically with any drugs. And I lost $15,000 on that, which I should get back. And that was 96, where compounded interest is $220,000 right now, if you do that.
You know, you were somebody that when you got locked up, you were not quiet. At least later on, you weren't quiet. I was able to learn a lot about your case and the situation that you were involved in by reading documents that you put out on your website.
Right.
So can you just talk about the being locked up and wanting to have a voice and doing whatever you could in those 28 years to, you know, keep your head and not lose your mind and not go down some avenues you could have gone and stayed focused and eventually get out?
The key is to stay busy. I was doing legal work, and I would put beautiful meritorious motions together. And Judge Gorton in Boston was just rubber stamping everything I did. He was a 33-degree Mason, multi-billionaire, had no transparent correspondent accountability whatsoever. He just did whatever he wanted. And so I kept busy with the legal work. I helped a lot of people get out of prison. I couldn't get myself out because I had a corrupt judge, corrupt prosecutors, and, you know, the whole thing was corrupt. But I ended up finishing the time, and, you know, here I am. But the key is not to go crazy, is to keep busy. And what I did was I opened up a site called Project Marino to uncover a lot of the a lot of the corruption within the FBI and Department of Justice. And then I did a lawsuit called Marino versus Department of Justice, if you can look it up, in Washington, D.C. And I fought them toe to toe for 10 years to get the documents that Congress left on the floor when they fought the Department of Justice, seeking the top echelon informant programs. It was heavily redacted, and they just withheld pages against Congress, which is a bipartisan group called. They titled their investigation "Everything Secret Degenerates: The FBI / Department of Justice Use of Murderers and Informants," which coincides with my case. So I did a lawsuit against the Department of Justice, fighting them to get all the documents they wouldn't give to Congress. And they fought me tooth and nail, and they just didn't want to get off anything. You know what I'm saying? But I did expose a lot that went on the, you know, for the, you know, judicial misconduct and, you know, FBI misconduct and stuff like that.
You know? I'm going to use an industry term. You had good SEO, which is search engine optimization. It means search engine optimization, meaning that you had a lot of names and phrases in what you posted that would come up on Google searches. So anytime anybody was Googling stuff related to that period, Project Marino would come up.
Right. And I think I gave the nickname that stuck. I called Richie Devil and Richie the Hatchet.
Richie the Hatchet, yeah.
That stuck on him. Right. And I think I gave Richie Gillis, who's actually a good friend of mine. He's really a good guy.
Richie
Nylund.
I gave
him the nickname Richie Nylund. Some of my monikers, some of my name did stick.
Any regrets looking back? What do you say now as an older man looking back on your younger self?
I mean, you never count on the corruption. I mean, who would ever think they would create, manufacture a case on me like this? But they did, and they got away with it, and I finished the time. So, you know, the best revenge is to be healthy and be very successful. And that's what I'm working on right now. In fact, I just put this book together called the Patriarchal Purge. Myself and Rex DePalma, who is a tremendous director, writer, producer,
yep,
that we're partners with, and Reign Supreme LLC. And we have a film coming out called Pressed, which coincides with what Trump has going on right now. Trump put a tariff against China, Mexico, and Canada for bringing in fentanyl in this country and killing off our youth. And they're getting that fentanyl and they're pressing it in pills. And that's what this movie's about. And that's coming up. We start shooting April 7th. And it's going to be a very, very interesting film. And what we hope to get out of this film to save American lives, specifically our youth, they won't be so quick of picking up that pill, smoking that weed from the street, where you can go to a dispensary or go to a pharmacy and get clean products, and they won't be dying. They're killing off our youth, like I said. Congress is on board with it. You know, the House, the Democrats, the Republicans, both Senate and the House, the president's on board with it. And, you know, this film just happened to come out. And, you know, Rex wrote the film, and he did it. And he wrote the screenplay, did a great job, and it's going to go somewhere. And then the next thing, which you might be interested in, is called the Patriarchal Purge TV miniseries, which we're going to start out with 8 episodes. And that's season one, and see where it brings us. Maybe we'll go season 2, 3, 4, 5. You know what I'm saying?
That exposes
a lot of the corruption.
So many opportunities now for people like yourself to take ownership of their own story. This is the new technology age that I'm sure that you're getting hip to now. But I'm telling you, some of this stuff that we're experiencing now has really only been, you know, it's in its real infancy. I mean, the internet's been around for 25 years-ish, 30 years-ish. But the ability to really take ownership of your own brand and your own story and not have to go through the gatekeepers and not have to deal with all the red tape and bureaucracy and wait for Marty Scorsese to come down from on high to come and say, I want. Now there's so many more opportunities to tell the story. And we're really excited for you to be able to tell your story further. And I've been talking to Rex about the movie, and it sounds just outstanding. Just not just a great story, but a great message. It's timely too. I don't want to get into names again. People can look it up, and I'm sure they might know who I'm talking about. But just out in Philadelphia, just a couple years ago, there was a big mob drug racketeering case where a couple of the guys got nailed for pressing pills, using a press to press pain pills. And so it's, and then I see it, I've seen it when I was working at my newspaper in Detroit, starting in the mid to late 2000s. I saw it, you know, bubbling, where you would have these suburban kids that in another era would never come anywhere close to heroin, but they see a pill that they can get, and they don't realize that pill that they're going to pop, let's say when they're 16, that when they're 18, they're going to be jabbing a vein with heroin. They don't do the math. They don't understand that pill is going to hook them on heroin. And that's how it got into the suburbs.
But that's if they're lucky to get past that pill, because that one pill could kill them, and it's been doing it to the youth of America. And we're trying to save lives with this film.
Yeah.
At the same time.
So let everybody know, in addition to the film that they're going to start production on next month, I'm guessing we'll be able to see that in 2026. Anything else that you want people to know about to find you and your story in 2025 right now?
I want them to know, first of all, that Rex DePalma is the next Martin Scorsese.
Yes.
And Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
He's going to be the new and improved Rex DePalma. And we're blessed to have him aboard with us. And his brother, Jake. Super intelligent. He's nobody knows about him, but he has a lot of brains.
We're rooting for you. We're going to do everything we can to help the cause here at OG Pod. And again, we celebrate the OGs. And Gigi, I don't say this lightly, but in a world now, and I'm sure that you must be astounded when you open your phone, or there are so many people out there that really aren't stand-up guys, that are guys that folded under pressure, guys that couldn't do what you did, and they're out there telling their, but this is the genuine article. You know, Gigi just swallowed a 30 piece and is coming out the other side of it, and he's got nothing to hang your head, nothing to hang your head about. You can keep your head up and your chest out proud because you did it the right way.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate you, allowing me this opportunity to be on this program. And remember, everybody,
so Patriarch Purge. Pressed. Or, so are we with the Patriarch or Purge book? Are you going to release that book? Or is it available right now?
It's on release on Amazon and Kindle Press.
Okay, so let everybody know to get Patriarch or Purge. It's being developed as a TV miniseries. Look out for Rex De Palma's Press movie that will probably be available. Will for sure be available in 2026. Shot in early 2025. You've done it all. You've said it all.
Miniseries, too. Patriarch of Purge miniseries. And another one, Crypto Terrestrial miniseries.
You're getting ambitious in your old age, man.
That too much. We'll keep it out of the boat.
We are always welcome on the OG to come and promote anything and chop it up with our audience. Again, we celebrate the OGs, and you are the definition of an OG. Thank you, Gigi Marino.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Rex, for setting this up. Benny behind the glass. I will see you guys next time. Please like, share, and subscribe. OG Pod. For Gigi, for Rex, and for Benny, we're out.